Well, hello everyone. Today I have a brief return. We're not actually entering back into the interview era, but I did ask Caleb Morpin back after I made a video or a series of videos basically calling for people to put aside some of their past differences and unite against a common enemy. And I mean, I wasn't taken aback. I kind of half expected it, but the sheer unwillingness of people even mentally to go there, right, made me raise half an eyebrow, because it's like almost nothing has been learned in the past decade of people kind of doing this sort of thing. And the person I thought might be good to talk to about this is somebody who's experienced it from the other side. Obviously, I'm coming from, generally speaking, the right side of politics, even though I have not been willing to call myself a rightist for about 3 or 4 years. It's still basically the side of things I'm associated with. Caleb, I think, is fair to say, is coming from the left, or coming from a kind of Marxist background. But as we've talked to each other before, you've experienced almost like the kind of mirror image of this, where it's difficult to, I've talked about the rightoid as somebody who is emotional, reflexively reactionary, cannot help but take the lowest bit of red meat that is flung to them, and it's incredibly frustrating to have to try to work with and deal with. But I'm led to believe that there is also such a thing as a leftoid, as a kind of like the left version of this, someone who's broadly speaking happiest when they're chomping at the bit and frothing with rage and hatred against the right winger as their enemy. In this country, I would say the British left is especially hateful in this regard. The people they see as their sworn mortal enemy, in this country, they call them the gammon, right? In America, I don't think there's an equivalent in America, but it's basically your kind of like MAGA hat wearing chud, white meat, whatever you want to call it. There's a particular type of individual that the left kind of delights in hating. Just like on the right, they're happiest when they're, I call it allowable racism or allowable bigotry, right? They're flung a bit of like, this guy's a Muslim, go and attack him for a bit type thing. Meanwhile, what I can see is the system and the people who are actually in power using divide and conquer tactics to keep people divided and to keep people distracted, to keep people fighting each other as opposed to fighting, the people at the top of the tree. So what do you think, Caleb?
Well, I mean, I think we're pointing to a problem that is much bigger than any political tendency. I mean, I hear you saying it about the right. I watched your videos about it, and I feel like these mirror my frustrations with the left over the years. But I think the first thing that we're seeing is there's a level of intellectual cowardice. People don't want to fight someone with more power than them. They want to pick on somebody who doesn't have more power. And that's blatant on the left with the cancel culture. It is way easier to go after some Starbucks worker who made a racist tweet and get them fired from their job than it is to actually question the power structure. And the cancel culture left is what you said. It's largely targeting working class people who they decide are racist or sexist and raging against them. And they're not really challenging the power structure. And it's easier to target people on the other side of the fence who have no power, who you consider to be backward or you consider to be wrong in some way. There's intellectual cowardice. There's also a lack of a desire to learn anything. And that's a really big problem on the left as well, is that it's easier to just point fingers at people and call them names than it is to actually dig into big questions and learn anything. If you've decided that somebody is wrong, and you just, you have a gut feeling, well, they're wrong, I'm offended by them, that's easier than doing any in-depth analysis and coming up with any real solutions. I think in a way that might be what you're pointing toward on the right, is that on the one hand, it's easier to go after somebody for being a Muslim than it is to go after like Zionism and the power structure, right? And then on the other hand, it's also more challenging if you have to learn about, you know, a new way of understanding things, make an ideological analysis, than to just point at somebody and say, well, you're bad and I hate you because you're bad. That's you know, easier intellectually. Would you say those two issues are manifesting?
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that's a little frustrating is that, you know, I guess it kind of works, it plays out in slightly different ways, right? Because I think on the left, generally, it's like a moral principle that you shouldn't be prejudiced, right? That you shouldn't be prejudicial against people for things that they have no control over, or even over things that they do have control over, right? Whereas, of course, on the right, it is, you know, it's a sign. In some ways, it's an outward sign of how "quote unquote" based you are, or how red-pilled you are. Okay, but there's a limitation to this. Okay, like for example, I'll give you an easy example. I've got one friend, okay, and people will know who I'm talking about, who is a trans. Okay, they're trans. Okay, now from my point of view, strictly speaking, probably like has a mental disability or condition, right? A medical condition that means they identify as a woman as opposed to identifying as a man. Can't do anything about that. Point is that I have the intellectual capacity to look past that, to look at what they are actually saying. What arguments are they making? Are they making good points? And to, you know, I teach a logic course and a rhetoric course. To attack the argument and not to attack the man, okay?
Right.
The problem is that, you know, it's just an easy gimme. If that person argues with anyone, they'll just say, oh, well, you know, you chop your dick off or whatever. And it's just like you're already into the realm of personal ad hominem, okay? And as things have gone in this sort of space, the more it has become sloppified, the more that it has become, I guess you'd say, like... playing to the lowest common denominator, the more those sorts of things stand in for actual positions. Now, I don't know if that goes on the left. I'd imagine that the left may even be above that sort of stuff, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong. So.
No, you argue with a leftist. I mean, you know, with a leftist with whom I disagree, it's almost a countdown. If I'm disagreeing with them and I'm taking them to task for identity politics or something like that, just give them, it's only a matter of time before the fact that I am a straight white male, how dare I, you know, that comes up immediately. So that almost immediately, you know, so no, what you're describing is very common. And I think in both cases, right, it's cheap, right? It's just an easy go-to, right? It's just, you know, and it's an ad hominem, and it's a way to just not listen to somebody because they are this, right? And then of course the logical response, like you said, is, you know, all kinds of people that may have a background you don't like or whatever are still capable of saying true things. So it's not an argument, but it's a cheap thing. And that the internet kind of brings out the worst in people.
I should say it's possibly not even a left right thing. It could just be like a human thing. I remember at different times, right? I mean, going back 6-7 years ago, when I got into a bit of hot water, I didn't support BLM back in the day. Right. And this led to, let's just say, problems for me in my professional life at that time. And I remember somebody made this tweet and he said, you know, I'm half Iranian, okay, half Welsh, half Iranian. And this person said, oh, well, he's not Iranian. We kind of disown him from the country because he didn't support BLM, because I didn't support BLM at that time. And it's funny because that has come back round, you know, in the current conflict, in the Iran war. You know, I've taken I'm pretty anti-Zionist, right? And I've taken a line. I'm not taking a pro kind of Iranian regime line or a pro Mullah line, but I've certainly been critical of what I call the twerking parvelists, like the monarchists, not only for the fact that they're completely delusional, right, but also for the fact that they have kind of prostrated themselves in an embarrassing and abject way in front of Israel and various other forces. in a way which I find embarrassing. But some of those characters have said, oh, well, he's not really Iranian for this sort of thing. And conversely, I have also discovered pretty much for the first time that I'm brown, Caleb, during the course of all of those arguments, because some of the, I guess, the pro-Zionist right, now they're looking for another angle to attack. You know, they've listened. It doesn't matter that they listened to me for the past 10 years. We disagree on this topic. So therefore, like, well, now he's brown, which is, yeah. I guess the inverse of your thing of, you know, the being a straight white male, and therefore you shouldn't be listened to in leftist circles. So I do think that people, you know, they look to attack, they look to make ethos based arguments, you'd say, right, to attack the character of the person and to discredit them as a trustable source, okay, as opposed to listening to the argument itself. I also happen to believe it's not that effective, but it does make getting anywhere quite difficult because you always have to deal with that crap first. And I also feel like it stops people asking, like last time we were on, Kayla, right? You were talking about, it was just after the Epstein files had released, and we were talking about Chomsky, right? And how Chomsky had almost been like a kind of court anti-war type figure. And since then, I've noticed that a number of others, like Norm Finkelstein, I don't know if I've got one of his books here. I think it's called The Holocaust Industry. But I also noticed that he also had come out with, you know, he suddenly landed on conclusions that are not natural ones. And I've started to kind of notice that. But it's like, I mean, I'm talking about the left now. It's like, have they forgotten what came out in the Epstein files? Because it seems like they just keep on reverting back. Like they didn't, that was only 2-3 months ago, and it's already like they've forgotten. So anyway.
Well, you know, I think when you describe these kind of ad hominems, I mean, part of it is the internet, right? That, you know, in person, it's very, your people are very unlikely in person, unless, you know, the fists want to start flying, right? You say to somebody, oh, well, you bait somebody over their race or their ethnicity. I mean, you know, those are fighting words. But on the internet, right, you can hide behind that, and people get a lot ruder and braver in the way that they talk about things. And I mean, there's that. And also what you were describing with this exile community. I mean, I was at Maduro's court date. I covered Maduro's recent court date in New York City, like about a month ago or whatever. And I remember I was down there, and all of these right wing Venezuelans were there. And also there were various Latin American leftists and like American leftists that were supporting Maduro there. And I will say what was it was scary, was they were in the same cage. Usually they have an opposite, you know, the police have opposite cages, but they were in the same cage. And the right-wing Venezuelans that are quite wealthy that live in New York City kept insisting that that no real Venezuelan would support Maduro. Oh, no real Venezuelan supports Maduro. There were a couple like leftist Venezuelans. You're not really Venezuelan. No real Venezuelan supports Maduro. And I remember thinking about this, and I hear this from the Iranian diaspora as well. No real Iranian doesn't want Israel and America to bomb Iran. And it's like they live in this alternate universe where like wars tend to have two sides, you know, not everybody. But they live in this world where everyone agrees with them. And, you know, every Iranian who marches in the streets to support, Khamenei is being paid or doing so at the barrel of a gun. And I mean, it's the same with Maduro. The millions and millions of people and the militias and the communes, no, none of them really support Maduro. All the Venezuelans, all the real Venezuelans are like them and have the CNN position. It's kind of a level of delusion that you hear with those folks. And what's frustrating is that a lot of Americans will base what they think they know about the country by talking to these folks, right? You know, I tell people that, you know, I mean, for years I've had people say to me, well, Caleb, you know, haven't you ever met anyone who actually lived under communism? And I would point them to the Poles and all the formerly communist countries of Eastern Europe where people say life was better overwhelmingly. And in fact, in Russia, you know, I've covered Russian elections. And in Russia, the Communist Party is a very large political party, and it's considered the party of the elderly, of the people who actually lived under it, you know? But we have this arrogant assumption. People say, well, I talked to a guy from Romania who lived down the street, and he told me. And it's like, well, yeah, but he's somebody who came to America, right, who moved here on top of that. Plus, on top of that, it, you know, in America, if he were to go around saying pro-communist things, he could lose his citizenship or his green card. I mean, it's one of the first questions they ask you, are you a communist? So, you know, I mean, people think talking to these right-wing Iranians or talking to these, you know, Venezuelans who live in Manhattan and live a luxury lifestyle after they fled Venezuela are representative of their country. And that's just simply not accurate. There's that. As far as Norman Finkelstein, you know, I will say, you know, I for a long time really appreciated Norman Finkelstein, but I've seen what he's been doing lately and it is disturbing. And there is, and again, I mean, this kind of gets back to, you know, what Trotsky, I talk about Trotsky, the spirit of the ghetto, right? What I hear, and I get very frustrated. There's this line that Israel cannot have any agency of its own. It's just a tool of U.S. imperialism. It's just the tool of U.S. imperialism. And having dealt with, you know, I don't know what you want to call them, crypto-Zionists on the left for so long, I know what they're really saying. All right. And that is, they're saying, my people are not the problem. It's those white Christians. That's what they're saying. This is an ethnic argument, right? It's that, you know, that their people, maybe they're doing bad things. Maybe they're chanting gas the Arabs. Maybe they just passed a law about hanging Palestinians. But really, the problem is the Europeans. And the problem is the white Europeans. It's not us. And I take particular offense to it. And I observed that for years on the left of, you know, we would see a mob of right-wing Zionists in New York City saying, kill the Arabs. And their response is, oh, that's so sad. But if they see a mob, a crowd of Trumpers, oh, they're evil. They all deserve to be killed. It's blatant racism. I mean, and it's that, that they, the problem, as far as they are concerned, is white European Christians. And they are the problem. So Israel must be somehow just a puppet of the evil white European Christians. That's what they're saying. In the early years of Israel, sure, in the 50s and 60s, you could say that Israel was kind of being controlled and used by the West. It was the Balfour Declaration that created Israel and all of that. But at this point, Israel very clearly is pulling the strings and is forcing U.S. imperialism to do things that the imperialists themselves are saying are not in their interest. You listen to Joe Kent. You listen to what's being said. I mean, Israel has a level of its own power and is pulling levers. That doesn't make U.S. imperialism or the globalist, you know, apparatus centered around the U.S. corporations and monopolies blameless. That's not what we're saying. But to make it sound that Israel is just a tool at this point is ridiculous. And it's also it's got a racial implication, you know, I must say, and that it's a manifestation of crypto Zionism. And you know, I mean, I could tell stories if you want. I mean, when I came back from Iran, I gave a speech, you know, to the leftist group I was in. And I remember they came at me and said, oh, how dare you? You know, and I was like, this is bizarre. I thought we were anti-Israel. Well, we're anti-Israel, but you have to be anti-Israel in our way. You have to be anti-Israel in a way that makes Zionists not the main villain. And I've been frustrated with that all along. And I feel like that's what I'm hearing from Norman Finkelstein, despite, I mean, I love his work and I respect a lot of what he's done over the years. I don't think this discredits him completely, but it's just an unfortunate turn that he's taking. And it kind of gets back to what you were saying about you always want to fight the other side. I think there's a real fear on his part of uniting with dissident MAGA, uniting with people on the right that are anti-Israel, right? That's a fear because there's this fear of the right wing that is just part of being a leftist. You have to just fear the right wing, and that we are entering a period where a real kind of left-right populist alliance could come into existence. And that goes against what a lot of lifelong activists on the left and the right have just spent their lives preaching. I mean, it just that just can't be, right? It's something that they're going to resist.
At the moment, to me, it feels like, I mean, again, maybe this is just wishful thinking on my part, but it feels like they're resisting gravity. When I see Tucker Carlson and the Young Turks and Anna Kasparian, you know, I mean, 10 years ago, Anna Kasparian and Tucker Carlson would have been mortal enemies. You'd never think of those two talking unless it was in an adversarial way. I mean, the famous meme of like Alex Jones screaming at Cenk and all of that from 10 years ago. Now they're all on the same page. Now they're all reaching the same conclusions. And to me, it's a pretty major signal that something's happening. To me, I'm kind of following. I'm like, well, that seems to be the natural concurrence that is happening. And we should lean. I mean, my view is that we should lean into it. Where if you see those guys as leading, we should kind of, you know, we should follow. They're creating a space for something interesting to happen. And I find the resistance to it curious, eyebrow raising, and in a way unnatural. When I say unnatural, what I mean is it doesn't seem to be coming from a sincere place. It seems to be coming from a place of special pleading or a space of, you know, not following what people would do if they were following the logic of what was happening.
You know, you pointed out in your video, like there's an element of like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But there's also like, it's the path of least resistance. This actually brings back a political memory from, you know, decades ago. Do you remember when the Ron Paul phenomenon was going around the time Obama was getting elected? You had the rise of Ron Paul. And suddenly, I remember I was a young Marxist communist in college, and all these people that I knew that were Republicans that had just blindly supported President Bush and the war on terror, and, you know, they supported torture, they supported all of it. All of a sudden, around the time Obama gets in, they're all libertarians. And they're all against the wars all of a sudden, these wars they've been supporting. They're all against it. And they're suddenly worried about our civil liberties, which they weren't worried about all this time. But the answer is we need real capitalism. And Bush is a communist. And, you know, we need to restore the republic. And communism is the main threat. And I remember getting very frustrated with those folks. It's like, okay, so all these things you blindly supported, you're now questioning, but you can't question the underlying ideology on the basis of which you supported them. But then at the same time, I got frustrated with the left because the left had no interest in talking to these folks. And I said, this is a big problem. People are suddenly, you know, we've been protesting these wars all of a sudden. Now people that were, you know, all blindly supporting these wars are against it, but ideologically they have a completely different narrative, and they're, you know, holding up Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and they're saying, you know, we need to, you know, go back to the gold standard, and we need to privatize everything. And, you know, this is a problem. People should be able, it should be that when people wake up and oppose the wars, they become like us. And the left's response to me was, no, we don't want to talk to these people. They're all racist. And anyone who would think that, they're so far gone. And I said, no, like, these people are waking up and opposing the wars and wanting to protest them and supporting Ron Paul. We should be able to debunk their views and engage with them. No engagement with these type of people. They're no good. No, we just need to build the movement. And build the movement meant support Obama. And that's what that meant, is build kind of leftist energy to support Obama. So I think back to that and those situations, it was like I was angry. I was frustrated with people that on the right that were kind of waking up, but not willing to question the underlying assumptions on which they had supported things. But I was also frustrated with the left for not wanting to intellectually engage. And that there's an element of people are afraid to learn. I think that's a really big thing. It's like, and that they want kind of the path of least resistance, kind of like what you're describing with this, you know, the way they're attacking this person on their identity. You don't have to learn anything, right? You know, oh, he's trans. Don't listen to her. He or she's trans. Oh, he's brown. You know, you don't have to learn anything. The same with the people on the left that, you know, it's like, well, the right is bad. The right is bad. Well, you don't have to listen to, you know, even if you disagree with something, and this is something I've thrown out a lot. If you really disagree with somebody, if there's some political current or trend that you really disagree with, you should ask yourself, why are people attracted to this? What does it give to people who follow it? That should be your question. Asking, you know, what's wrong with it is too easy because you already know that, because you don't like them. You already know what's wrong with them. But you should ask yourself, what attracts people to this political trend? Why are they drawn to it? What does it do for them? You know, and I've talked a lot about like polemics, right? And in the Marxist movement, there's a history of polemics, right? Where it's like they contrast, you know, Marx is writing about, well, this person says this and I say this. You can spot a good polemic and you can spot a bad polemic. A bad polemic is nitpicky. It finds a sentence and it says, ah, well, this, you said this, and what you actually mean is this. Aha, I've exposed you. That's cheap. But a really good polemic means that you really investigate the other perspective and you really learn what they're saying. And you understand why people are attracted to it. You understand their strengths, what the appeal of it is. And you really get to the essence of it. And then you contrast it with your own. That's a polemic that you can really learn from. Whereas somebody who's just looking to, you know, they've already decided the other person's wrong. They don't really want to learn that much. And so they just kind of, they're looking for a few quotes to call the person bad. You know, that's a lazy polemic. But the good polemic is one where you really digest your political opponent. You come to understand them. You learn from them. And in the process, you learn your own perspective more. That's a really good polemic. And a good polemic is useful. A bad polemic is not worth anything.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking there, Caleb, about the spirit of intellectual charity, you know, which, you know, certainly when I was training in university and so on, you were always encouraged to approach everything, every argument, but to try to steel man the opposition and approach it with intellectual charity, because that's the nature of intellectual work. You don't go in trying to just destroy them or whatever, which again, I guess, is part of a kind of bad internet culture. I will say, though, that in history, the buddy-up, the libertarian left-wing anti-war buddy-up has happened at least once successfully. This was in the 1960s when Murray Rothbard was young, and they were against the Vietnam War in the 60s there. And there was a left-right alliance, a libertarian right-left anti-war alliance. What's interesting, and this is the slightly irritating thing, because there's no getting away from this question, when you're dealing with a war, that is Israel's war, right? Because one of, Murray Rothbard is dead now, right? But one of his great disciples and students, a man called Walter Block, guy who I've met, by the way, you know, he's written lots of books. I've got a book there by him called Defending the Undefendables, where he literally defends the free market by saying actually that the pimp and the prostitute and the ticket tout and the tax cheat, all of these people are doing like services, right? For this is a kind of ultra libertarian argument,
right?
But he, right, that same Walter Block, rather than for this war, be anti-war or remake the right-left alliance. Instead, he is like an ultra Zionist, ultra pro-Israel, libertarian argument for Israel, et cetera, to the extent where rather than have the right-left buddy up, as Murray Rothbard did against the Vietnam War, for this war, Walter Block has spent his time feuding with Hans Hermann Hoppe, got himself kicked out of the Mises Institute after four decades. Hopper has now left the Mises Institute. So what we've had is internal libertarian drama, right? And I'm not in libertarian circles anymore, but I just know that this has been going on. And I cannot help but think, what's different about this one for Walter Block versus all the other wars? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, you know, maybe it's because he's got some affinity for Israel himself personally. You know what I mean? It's just unavoidable to start seeing these things once you see them. It's like, well, he's not landing on the natural conclusions that every other libertarian has landed on. Why is that then? You know, but anyway, I imagine similar splits, I guess, have been happening all over the left where, you know, they're not prepared to. I mean, I've noticed, for example, Caleb, that the anti-war stuff has been muted. It was no kings. Why wasn't it an anti-war protest? What was going on there?
Well, yeah, our organization, we actually blocked the march. I don't know if you saw, we were out in the streets and we brought our people and we created kind of a ruckus in New York City by blocking the parade with Iranian flags. And that was something that we were able to do. And that you'll notice Chuck Schumer, actually, some of his statements, he's criticizing Trump. It's like he's afraid Trump will end this war too soon and not get a good deal. And they have this slogan the Democrats are using now, taco for Trump always chickens out. And mm-hmm. So it's like at the same time, they're kind of pretending to be against Trump's war. They're like saying Trump's not aggressively doing it or something. Like it's the Democrats are not really against this war. And that's the important thing to remember. But when you bring up the right and the libertarian right, I keep coming back to, and I talk about this, I had this little like booklet I wrote, The Divisions in the Ruling Class. And I talk about, you know, there's a case of, there was a guy who was like a big Marxist in the 1960s, kind of a Marxist teacher. He went by Lynn Marcus, and he's now known to the world as Lyndon LaRouche. Do you know about him?
I don't think so. I know I haven't come across.
Well, he's a bizarre case. He was a New York City like Marxist intellectual in the 1960s, but he kind of developed a political current that is now, I mean, for a while they were considered on the right. They supported Ronald Reagan and they're just kind of their own thing. And there's even like splits and he's long dead, but it's a political current. This guy was Lyndon LaRouche. He went by Lynn Marcus. He was a Trotskyite Marxist, but he was anti-Malthusian. And he came to the conclusion that the new left was promoting Malthusian economics, which he read as inherently opposed to Marxism. Marx believed in historical progress, believed in the population expanding, believed in, you know, great creating greater wealth with a planned economy. And he kind of developed a political current in the late 60s that was called the National Caucus of Labor Committees, the NCLC. And if you looked at what they believed, it was like Marxism with John Birch Society characteristics, right? So the John Birch Society, the far right group, if you really read their literature, they're against communism. But if you really read it, they think communism is a capitalist conspiracy. And they're against the mainstream left, which they see as tied to communism and funded by the Ford Foundation and Wall Street Institutes and all of that. And then their literature, they talk about Plato versus Aristotle and, you know, democracy versus republic. And that what Lynn Marcus or Lyndon LaRouche kind of did is he took the Marxist economics and then he kind of applied a John Birch Society narrative to it, where the most evil capitalists were the ones that were funding the left that wanted Malthusianism. Right. And that was kind of the basis for, and he developed a political trend that was kind of, but what he was pointing to is that, and this is a problem, is that people on the left, they think the entire right wing is a big conspiracy. No one on the right wing has any anti-establishment views. It's all just a big conspiracy from the establishment. People on the right think that everyone on the left is from the establishment. They're all paid protesters. No one on the left has any anti-establishment view. Neither of those things are true, right? There are elements on the left that are at odds with American imperialism and globalism. There are elements on the right that are at odds with American imperialism and globalism. And that is something that neither side wants to acknowledge, right? But what we're really against is the rule of the world by these big monopolies, right? These ultra monopolies that are dominating the world, the big banks and financiers that need the wars in order to preserve their system, et cetera. And that the right has largely in America been the expression of like industrialists and lower level capitalists and small business owners who see the big monopolies and see their ties to the left as a way to secure their monopoly. They kind of see it as like the Roman Republic. They're building a mob of lumpen poor people in order to pass laws and regulations to secure the monopoly of the big corporations. And so they're kind of defending their position as a small business owner against the mob of poor people mobilized by the ultra rich. That's the view of the far right. That's the view of the John Birch Society. The left, on the other hand, they view themselves as fighting the big monopolies and on behalf of the working class majority, and they're building this mass working class movement. And then they view the small business owner or whatever who's calling for deregulation, they view him as just a puppet of the big monopolies. At the end of the day, right, it is the monopolies that we're opposing. And we have like the middle class current that tends to be libertarian that is opposing them. And we have the working class and the labor union current that tends to be socialist. But the big monopolies are ultimately what the problem is, right? And that these are kind of, you know, both sides want to fight the big monopolies, but both sides end up kind of being manipulated into fighting not the big monopolies, right? The libertarian wants to fight the big monopolies, but he ends up fighting the labor unions and fighting the leftists and calling for deregulation, which aids the big monopolies. The leftist wants to fight the big monopolies, but really they end up kind of helping the big monopolies because they're beating down the libertarian and the small business owner who would oppose them. And the monopolies will help write the rules. And the monopolies are providing the funding for a lot of the leftist activism through the Ford Foundation and such. But what the communists advocated, if you go back to the 1950s, right, William Z. Foster and the communists advocated at the dawn of the Cold War, they called for an anti-monopoly coalition. that would include small business owners, right? And that would include all kinds of people against the big monopolies that are driving war. And if you look at the Chinese flag, what does the Chinese flag stand for? You got the big star, that's the Communist Party, and then the four stars are the block of four great classes, which was the worker, the peasant, the middle class shopkeeper, and the national capitalist. And there were, you know, millionaires in China up into the 1960s. It wasn't really until the 1960s that they really started nationalizing things. And throughout the 1950s, there were a layer of wealthy millionaires who came over to Mao's side because Mao was teaming up with the Soviets to build the power plants and pave the roads and do things that would benefit the economy overall. And that's kind of that you have a layer of like small business owners. That's the far right in America. You have the labor movement and you have, you know, kind of, you know, working class constituencies. In a lot of cases, ethnic, you know, it's like the black community kind of, you know, an ethnic kind of communities that are kind of a basis of the left. And they end up kind of being used against each other. And they both kind of, if you look at the essence of what they really want, they want to fight the big monopolies. They're opposing the big monopolies. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you, look, last time you came on, you mentioned an author that I got interested in, which was Palm Dutt.
Yeah.
Remember you mentioned Palm Dutt to me? And I picked up a pile of books by Dutt, including this one called Britain's Crisis of Empire, right? And it was this is just an aside that Dutt had in this book, but it opened up a kind of a, you know, when you're one of those moments where a penny drops, right? He says, basically, you know, cut a long story short, he says, look, the Fabian Society, right, that is the mainstream left tendency in Britain, right, the non-communist left, the Fabian Society, as against the conservative. But he says, look, if you think about it, in, you know, it's the Tory versus the Fabian in Britain, mainstream British politics. If you think about what they're doing, the Fabian is the way that the British establishment, and he's talking about British Empire there, justifies the British Empire to the left, right? I.e., yeah, we're still doing imperialism, but it's progressive. We're just going to call it progressive. We're going to put nice language on it, right? But ultimately, what it's doing is it's justifying the status quo, right, to the left. The Tories, meanwhile, do exactly the same thing, but they're justifying it to the right. And when I say exactly the same thing, I mean exactly the same thing. So if you think about classic Fabianism, it is gradual change, not revolution. Okay? Gradual change, not revolution. And so fascinated was I by what Dutt's little comment that I went back and I read a Fabian book from the 50s, which had an essay by Roy Jenkins in it. And in that, he says, look, if we had the revolution that we all wanted, okay, we wouldn't have a one-party state, he said. He said, if there wasn't a conservative party, we would have to invent it. Roy Jenkins said that. And I was like, why do the Fabians see the Tories and the conservative, or in America it would be the Republican Party, as a structural necessity for them? Why do they want them there? Well, he says, look, the population aren't going to accept radical change. You know, I mean, on the right, we've got this, we call it progressivism driving at the speed limit. So the Fabians make this argument where they say, well, look, we know that the conservatives are spineless cowards who just justify power. We know that's what they do. So look, we take two steps forward. Then when we put the Tories in power, well, they'll do some of the stuff, but they won't undo all of it. So in that way, they turn the ratchet tiny little bit. But in the end, if you think about it, when we talk about the two parties being the same, if you think about it, you know, other than that tiny little change, they're literally doing the same thing. The Burkean conservative says, we want gradual change at a kind of manageable pace. Boiling the frog slowly, okay. Exactly the same as the Fabians. And so for me, the thing that went off is that actually these are just two different ways of justifying the establishment, one to the left, one to the right, or one, if you want to put it in the terms you had, one to the little shopkeepers and so on and so forth, or the other one to the great unwashed masses or the plebs.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I have read H.G. Wells, you know, New World Order, I think, and that's a Fabian text. And in it, he calls himself a socialist, but he's also a Malthusian. He believes there's too many people in the world. And some of the rhetoric he uses doesn't sound that different from the way, you know, some of the people on the right, you know, argue, right? There is this belief that some people are just better than others. And that if you look behind closed doors, on both sides of the political spectrum, the people at the top, what they believe in is Nietzsche. It's Nietzsche, it's philosophical irrationalism, it's Leo Strauss. It is this belief that the masses are the problem, and the masses are inherently backward, are inherently dangerous, and totalitarianism, in their view, is when the masses of people get together and impose their will. That's what they're against. And that's what they see in all these regimes they don't like. That's what they think Iran is. Iran is the masses coming together and imposing their will. That's what the Venezuela is. That's what Putin in Russia is. That's what China is. They're not really, they make the leader the target, but it's really, they see these regimes as the unwashed masses, if you want to call them that, or the bulk of the population coming together and asserting its will and not letting the naturally superior ones just rise to the top. That's what they believe. And they believe that at the end of the day, there really is no truth, and that truth, you know, can be that great individuals can impose their truth onto the world, and that attempts to say that there is truth in the world are totalitarian. And that's what needs to be fought against. This is the postmodernist worldview. And this is the left postmodernists believe this, the right believes this. And that seems to be what the elite believe. They are against the masses of people. You know, on the left, they emphasize climate change. We got to reduce the population. We got to reduce spending. It's the Malthusian stuff, the Malthusian environmentalism. On the right, it's the worship of the free market. And they view any attempt, you know, to control the economy, they view that as communism, as socialism, and the market is just natural because the superior ones rise to the top. But it's this kind of radical individualism, anti-humanism, anti-populism, and ultimately it's philosophical irrationalism, right? I believe Lukács wrote the text, you know, talking about the intellectual continuity between from Nietzsche to the Nazis. And he was saying, look, that there is this belief that you can just impose your will onto reality. And that's kind of the basis of all this. And what I think is interesting is if you look at the foundation of Western civilization, it wasn't irrational, right? I think about masonry and how masonry was such a key element in the Protestant, governments and in Britain's rise. You had, you know, and the symbol of masonry is you have that G surrounded by the compass and square, and that G stands for God, but also for geometry. Right. And the understanding was the laws of mathematics prove that there is divinity, prove that there is order in the universe. I mean, it seems like the West was kind of founded on rationalism. It was celebrating individual rights. It was certainly critical of religious institutions. And it was kind of the Protestant Reformation and also kind of rejecting the rule of the Catholic Church. But it seems like the West was kind of founded on rationalist premises. But at some point, especially in the 1950s, perhaps in the course of the Cold War, rationalism became replaced by irrationalism and the belief that rationalism was totalitarian. If anyone tells you that there is actual reality, they're going to create a Stalinist or Nazi authoritarian state and take away the freedom of the intellectuals. So we must rebel against reality itself. That seems to be part of the thinking. And that philosophical irrationalism, the worship of the individual, that is the anti-human, anti-populist sentiment, the belief that human beings are the problem. That's what the elite believe, the left, the right, the center. That's what they all think. I mean, have you observed the same thing?
It's kind of it's tricky because from certain dissident right, I guess you'd call them, perspectives, the problem is the Enlightenment. So you get this kind of like where you have, I have this book here by Isaiah Berlin. It's a pretty famous one. Where is it? Where he talks about the counter-Enlightenment thinkers. He's talking about Vico and Haman. And I don't know if you're familiar with these sorts of. So it became very trendy, I would say, on the right to attack the Enlightenment as the issue in and of itself through this sort of lens. In Prophets of Doom, one of my books, I deal with a lot of counter-Enlightenment thinkers, as well as people like Evola and so on and so forth. And how can I put this? So yeah, that's one route that you can get. You can actually end up in quite a postmodern position from the right when you go down the route of critiquing the Enlightenment in that sort of way. Another way is just mainstream conservatism. There's a Oakeshott, I don't know if you're familiar with him. There's Michael Oakeshott. He's one of the kind of main mainstream British conservative thinkers, but he's pretty influential in America as well. They have this idea that rationalism with a capital R is the kind of road to hell. Like, the, you know, you cannot rationally plan anything because there's a fundamental mystery to life, something like this. I'm probably butchering Oakeshott, but in kind of shorthand. So you do end up with these sorts of this sort of distrust of rationalism, I would say, on the right. I would want to make a kind of, and again, we're kind of splitting kind of hairs here, but I want to make a distinction between rationalism and the use of logic, right? For example, if you read the medieval scholastics, they're incredibly logical in the way that they approach thinking. Okay, you'd call it like their capital L logos, something like this. But you wouldn't call the scholastics rationalist, because rationalism has a name in philosophy, right? From Descartes and these sorts of thinkers. So yeah, broadly speaking, I think you're right. But there's, I mean, if we probably get too much into the weeds of like philosophical tradition as to what exactly rationalism is, right? Because I do think that there's a certain type of Enlightenment thought that led to things that have rightly been critiqued, like, for example, utilitarianism, right? Or Jeremy Bentham-style utilitarianism. You know, it's obvious to see that there are some shortcomings to this, right? How would you come back on that?
No, I hear you. And that, you know, it's vague. It's kind of, we're describing kind of a sentiment that, and I've noticed that with a lot of politics, is that a lot of politics is not, it's not like people don't clearly articulate their ideas. When I think about Alexander Dugin, for example, I read his book, The Fourth Political Theory. And what I got from it was that he expressed what people around the world who reject the West and the dominance of the West believe. And they already believed it before he wrote it. They didn't believe it because he wrote it. He was kind of, you know, giving voice to what people felt, whether people are in Venezuela, whether people are in Iran and the Muslim world, whether people are in Asia. And, you know, Alexander Dugin's fourth political theory was kind of saying, look, there's elements of left, what we think of as left, and there's elements of right that both kind of oppose the West and are collectivist in nature. And it's through, you know, reading Alexander Dugin's fourth political theory, I understood how like Mao and Confucius walk hand in hand in China now. That doesn't make any sense, right? Mao wanted to eradicate Confucius. Confucius was all about tradition and hierarchy, and you know, you would think that they were opposed, but they're both part of China's unique identity that is collectivist and not Western, right? And so China can be proud of Mao and they can be proud of Confucius, and they're both Chinese and not the West, right? And that's what I got from reading Alexander Dugin. And it's like Alexander Dugin didn't invent these sentiments. He just kind of went around the world to see people that were opposing the West and kind of understood, like, after the Cold War, after Marxism-Leninism is no longer the defining way of viewing things among people that oppose the dominance of Western globalism and imperialism, what do they believe? And his book, The Fourth Political Theory, was just kind of giving voice to that. And that what we're describing among the elite, a lot of them probably don't even consciously think this, right? A lot of them probably don't, you know, they have to hire some professor to sit down and say, well, what we think is this. This is just an impulse they have, that they are superior, that the masses are the enemy. The world is going to hell because the masses are breeding too much and there's too many of them. They think this. They don't know why they think it. But that is just kind of, and then, you know, they you know, they have to develop the Open Society Institute and pay a bunch of academics to come up with an intellectual, you know, rhyme or reason to justify it. You know, one thing that my organization, the Center for Political Innovation, is doing is we're about to launch the American Juche Study Group. We're going to study the Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il's writings. And we're actually going to do kind of an experiment with it, which is that we are going to have the studio for these online study sessions open, that anyone can join. Anyone can just jump on. Right. And we're publishing a volume of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il's writings. It'll be volume one. And we're launching a study session in which the studio will be open and anyone can just come in. And we're doing it because, you know, North Korea, you look at it, it's kind of like the ultimate negation of the West. Right. North Korea is this country that's faced an all out bombardment. They're facing all kinds of sanctions. They've, you know, proliferated nuclear weapons because they feel like that's the only way they can stay in power. And you know, it's the only way they can withstand. And that North Korea, to have faced everything that they faced, any other government would have collapsed in the 1990s when they had that imposed food crisis on them, right? That there's something about North Korea and its ideology that is worth investigating and studying. And we're launching in kind of a provocative way this study group as a way of just kind of, we want to just read the ideology of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il and as continued by Kim Jong-un and discuss it. And we're excited to see how this will develop because, again, you know, North Korea, in order to withstand and oppose the Western system, they have very much held on to an opposite worldview, and that Marxism-Leninism is their foundation. But oddly, what we saw when we going over the Juche perspective is they came to very similar conclusions that we came to. I mean, at one point, you know, Kim Jong-il says we're not materialists. You know, we're not hard materialists. We do believe that man has creative ability and that human willpower and human belief does, you know, have an impact on reality. So in a similar way to the way Center for Political Innovation and our perspective is kind of broken with materialism. And, you know, I do believe in God and I also believe in the power of the human will. I found that in Kim Jong-il's writings as well. So I think we're going to have some fun with that for sure. And the point I've noticed, and I think this is what was coming across in your critique of the right, is guys like you and me, what we're constantly trying to do is get people to think. And a lot of people don't want to think, and they will do everything they can to avoid thinking, right? You know, and guys like you and I, our job is we're constantly trying to drag the horse to water and make him drink. We're trying to get people to think. And we have a society that trains people not to think. And it's interesting because Wallace Wattles, the kind of socialist and kind of self-help thinker who was a close friend of Eugene Debs, you read his writing, he just says, think. And that really the battle of history is just kind of challenging people to think, getting people to think. That humanity is asleep, kind of. Humanity is kind of, you know, and that humanity, it's not that the elites, you know, brainwash and hypnotize us. We want to brainwash and hypnotize ourselves because we want to avoid thinking. We have this fear of thinking. And that the great prophets of history, you look at, you know, Muhammad, Jeremiah, Jesus, what are they doing? They're trying to get people to think. They're people that have some capacity to think and some connection to divinity. And they come to the earth and they say, think, right? Socrates, they're saying, think. And the masses are horrified. No, we don't want to think. And in some cases, the prophet gets stoned to death. But in other cases, the prophet is able to awaken people and get them to think and actually advance human history and build something better. Do you think that kind of applies to what we're doing? We're trying to get people to think. People don't want to think, and it's the challenge of history.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the, you know, one of the more important things that the right has been doing when it's at its strongest over the past decade or so, and partly going over, the resurgence of people like Julius Evola and Dugin, I think, has just written a book on Evola, you know, Carlyle, who I've got here, and many other thinkers in kind of right, kind of, I guess, the tradition of the radical right. It is exactly in the rejection of a purely materialist worldview, saying that actually all through history there is something else, there is something transcendent, there is a posture looking upward, looking up, right? And that everything in our modern life encourages us to look down all the time, or encourages us not to ask those bigger questions, or to, you know, just consume and watch sports ball and eat Doritos or whatever else, right? Eating your slop. And in a way, that I think is the thing that you know, I think it is the best thing to come out of, you know, recent kind of rightist thought. Unfortunately, the mainstream, for various different reasons, just is not prepared to go there. It wants to stay wedded to a type of, I mean, in this country, a type of 1980s Thatcherism, right? To remain, I mean, to me, when people are talking about capitalism versus communism, this is a very 20th century and very materialist, very material. And I feel like you can kind of see it all around you, right? I mean, when I was a kid, you know, when I went, like when people went to the gym or whatever, there weren't classes of middle-class women doing yoga, for example, right? Now you could say, well, it's been bastardized, it's been mainstreamed, it's been commodified. So all, yeah, all of that stuff, yes. But also I get the impression that there's something in the ether that people know that there's more out there, that the people want more than just, you know, food and shelter, which I know Marx says is the first thing, right? Morals follow on, but people have a higher order of needs as well as just simply the basics. People want something else. And that's probably, you know, some, I mean, it's happened. Like, if you have a look on YouTube, if you have a look, there is something in the water that is happening despite everything else. Like, it's even a dimension in, like Tucker Carlson once in a while that mentions demons and things like that, which is odd, slightly irritating for me. But also, there's a spiritual dimension to what's happening everywhere. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, totally, totally. You know, and I think one of the manifestations, I mean, you know, back to kind of what you were describing in your frustrations, you know, is I noticed a big trend with the bread tube left was that the argument stopped being, you know, we're critiquing Western capitalism, we're critiquing colonialism. It started becoming, the argument really got down to, if you watched ContraPoints, had this video, how to spot a Nazi, the secret signs. And it was almost like they were doing this like Da Vinci Code thing. That's what I called it in my BreadTube book, BreadTube Serves Imperialism. You know, the Da Vinci Code, it's right, you know, all the secret codes we're going to decode. And it was like there was a secret conspiracy within the government of people that were secretly members of the Aryan white supremacist thing. And we're going to like decode all the hand signs and all this. And it was the most juvenile, don't listen to what anyone's saying, don't challenge ideas. We're just going to find, we're going to root out the secret leftist conspiracy by looking at their secret hand signs and the secret code words that they use. And it was just the most idiotic thing. And if you ever disagreed with these people, they immediately started looking into you to make the case that you're secretly a Nazi. And like, I remember when I had people like attacking me because on my blog at the time, there was a post 666, you know, 666. And there was another post, you know, that was number 13. And so that was 1388. I mean, you know, it's just this idiotic. They're not thinking, right? You know, dig into what I'm actually saying and find, tell me where I'm wrong. But no, I'm going to prove that you made a hand sign that you're secretly part of this. And then I noticed there's a woman in America, you know, who's on the right. She's like a right wing libertarian and she does Socialism Saturday. Right. And she does these videos and she's quite popular on the right. And I think she claimed she infiltrated Antifa or something. And it's like she claims she has this like insider knowledge because she can go to socialist groups' websites and show the videos of their speeches. And it's like, you know, she had this great revelation. It was like 3 or 4 months ago. She was doing the rounds of the right wing podcast. Her great discovery was, you know, these communists, they're organizing demonstrations on May 1st, May Day, right? This is secretly part of the communist. And I'm just watching this and I'm like, and these right wingers are watching this like it's some kind of deeply profound, insightful knowledge that they're getting. And it's like she knows about the secret communist conspiracy behind everything. And it's just, again, she's not digging into the arguments that these people are making. She's just, you know, it's aha. It's very surface level. And again, you know, if you want to find out what communists and socialists believe, you can easily find out what they believe and you can talk about it. If you want to find out what people on the far right believe, you can easily dig it up and find it out, but they don't want to find it out. And it's, if you frame it as some kind of hidden conspiracy within the highest levels of the government, you know, that's a way to avoid, you know, just finding out what these people believe, digging into it and debunking it. Right. And that's with the far right, with the far left, right? Read fascist tracks and find out what's wrong with them. Read leftist tracks and find out what's wrong with them. That's real intellectual work. But if you just, you know, run this kind of conspiracy narrative, it's kind of like feeding the fear of the other side. Have you observed these kind of trends among the right?
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that there's a certain degree of conspiracy stuff that is containment, basically. That there's a set of, like I call it, like allowable targets. You know, I mean, I remember there was a whole period where people would do like videos on Scientology and things like this.
Right, yeah.
It's like, well, who cares? I mean, are the Scientologists really running like the government or something? No. So, I mean, it's just salacious. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like you can take time out to give them a kick in because it's safe.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas certain, but I also think that it's used as a broad tactic to discredit the very notion that there could be groups with agendas at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I remember the left, broadly speaking, used to share this triangle. It was like a pyramid. It's called the pyramid of conspiracy. And it would start like down at the bottom with, you know, fairly reasonable claims. And then it would, you know, right at the top, it would be, you know, have the most, you know, like alien people in the world. But in there, right at the top, it would also have just like the word George Soros. And I'd be like, well, hold on, George Soros does fund an awful lot of dodgy shit, you know,
right.
But that's put on the same level as like UFOs or whatever else. Do you know what I mean? So it's right. A broad tactic to try to prevent anybody looking into anything. And it, in fact, it was particularly prevalent during the whole COVID era, where there was quite a big crackdown on anybody asking any questions, you know, where, I mean, we almost saw... I always saw like, you know, everybody on the left reads Michel Foucault and his stuff about the clinic and how the science is used as a control grid and so on. That was very marked during COVID, where, you know, the I mean, in this country, almost no discussion was even allowed on any side. So,
yeah, well, you know, I saw that, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center was just indicted. And this conversation, that pyramid thing you just shared reminds me of like, I called them out in like 2010. Because the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, I mean, they're this group in America that sues Nazis, right? And that they made that their career. And recently they were indicted for allegedly funding Nazis, right? You know, it's like the fire department that wants more funding, right? They go on an arson spree, and it's kind of amusing. But, you know, they had a lot of respect at one point in leftist circles. But I remember in 2010, when I was still on the left, I was on their email list, and I got an email from them that infuriated me. Because it was like, the email was like the top 10 right-wing lies. And lie number one was FEMA camps, right? Is that Alex Jones and the conservatives say that the federal government is building these camps to put leftists in, or to put, you know, the right-wing patriots in. No such camps exist. No law has ever existed. This is just a crazy thing. And I remember I emailed the Southern Poverty Law Center at the time, because I was studying American history, and I knew very, very well that laws to put people in camps did exist. The McCarran Internal Security Act of 1951. Those FEMA camps were built during McCarthyism for communists, right? The McCarran Internal Security Act was that, you know, that if there was a state of national emergency declared, 2 million people would be placed in temporary, you know, prison camps by the American government. And that McCarran Internal Security Act, which was an anti-communist law, which was passed during the height of McCarthyism, did exist. And Alex Jones and others were pointing to that law. And why was the Southern Poverty Law Center saying that no such law exists, when then if you want to debunk Alex Jones, all he has to do is pull up that law exists and point to it. If you really want to challenge the right, I said to them at the time, point out that this law does exist, but it's targeting communists. It's targeting Marxists, and that their narrative that this is, you know, that this is, it's the communists who invented the law, and it's communist Obama who's doing it because he wants to round up gun owners, doesn't match what the law actually says, because communists are the target. But I noticed that there was stuff like this where it was like debunking the right and glossing over true things that the right said, and rather than quibbling with the true things, we're just going to, and like George Soros is a great example, right? George Soros is an anti-communist. George Soros toppled Marxist governments. That's his whole background, is he funded color revolutions to overthrow Marxist governments and bring in free market capitalism. I mean, he was a promoter of neoliberal shock therapy economics. He's not a communist in any conceivable way. He is, you know, the liberal color revolution imperialist who toppled communist governments. But generally, the way George Soros is talked about in America, you get people on the right, and he's a communist. Why is he a communist? Because he funds left-wing protests, right? And he's a communist because everything to the left, everything that is not in line with my conservative worldview is therefore Marxist-Leninist and just like Stalin, very juvenile. And then on the left, if you ever mention George Soros, they say, you're right-wing, you're being anti-Semitic, that's a conspiracy theory. Well, no, George Soros does exist. Let's have a conversation about who he really is and how he's not a communist, he's an anti-communist, but he's the liberal wing, the kind of European mainland liberal wing of imperialism, the liberal CIA, the color revolution. Let's have a conversation about that. But we don't want to have that conversation. On the right, he's a communist, and everyone to the left of us is actually a communist. On the left, you're not allowed to mention his name or else you're right wing. Stop spreading right wing conspiracy theories. And as a result, nobody learns anything. Right. And that's the frustrating thing. And that the reason that the left has largely turned on me and the reason that I've been kind of banned from leftist spaces, I can't go and cover a Palestine rally without people harassing me. I know you, you're bad, is because I just won't go along with this. I'm not going to, if you tell me I'm not allowed to say George Soros's name, because then I'm right wing. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell you, no, George Soros is a real person. And there's an interesting story there. And there's information there. I want to think. And again, this is kind of what we're getting back to, is that we have to challenge people to think. And I know it gets very, very frustrating, but I want to encourage you to keep going, keep challenging people to think as hard as it is. Right. And that I think we're describing the same thing. You're saying that people on the right, they don't want to think. They just want to point fingers. You're Muslim, you're brown, you're transgender, Well, that's lazy, and you are trying to get people to think. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get people to think, and that ultimately the challenge of building some kind of anti-establishment movement is awakening people to actually engage with ideas and think.
Yeah, I mean, if all the people who didn't like George Soros united together, maybe they could do something about George Soros, right? Or something like this. I mean, this is the very nature of, I mean, you know, the left like to talk about the oligarchs or the billionaires who are in control. But then you actually point to them. Now you're a conspiracy theorist or something like this. You know, it's like, well, you know, I mean, I remember it was the same during COVID, right? It was Bill Gates at that time funding all sorts of things that people had a problem with, but immediately they were conspiracy jacketed. Whereas in fact, ideally what would happen is it doesn't matter where you're from, right or left, people would have a right to know, well, who voted for Bill Gates, you know, yeah. Or Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison has been gifted, a news organization that he bought for Barry Weiss. He bought TikTok, gifted by the Trump admin. They tried to buy the Panama Canal for Larry Ellison at one point. I don't know if that actually went through. You know, he's the number one funder of Tony Blair. He's the number one funder of the IDF. Now, in a sane country, you'd be able to have a conversation about Larry Ellison. But nobody wants to have that conversation for some reason. This is
earlier about Scientology, you know, that's very interesting because, you know, Scientology is a sect, and their origins may have connections to American intelligence. I know L. Ron Hubbard was U.S. Navy intelligence at one point, and, you know, and they were very well connected in Hollywood. But 10 or 15 years ago, the establishment circled their wagons and they said, we're getting rid of this group. And I'm not here to defend that group and their beliefs. I don't agree with them. I know they're illegal in Russia, and a lot of anti-imperialist countries consider them some kind of Western intelligence outlet. But when the establishment circled their wagons against them, it was not coming from a good place. For example, one of their beliefs, I believe they're against medicines. They're against big pharma, right? That they don't believe in psych meds. And psych meds are a huge industry now. I mean, an American's taking psych meds like crazy. And I think that they just had too much power in Hollywood and they got targeted. And I noticed that, you know, it was like all the documentaries, Leah Remini and all this stuff. This is an abusive organization and stuff. And there may very well have been. I'm not here to defend them, but the attacks were, this is kind of when I talk about the Khrushchevism, right? It's like they want to discredit any kind of movement. They don't want you to join any movement. It's a cult. It's, you're being taken advantage of. Just stay home and let us brainwash you with the algorithms. Don't join any movement. It was that kind of Khrushchevist, you know, anti-mass movement narrative. number one. The other thing is I noticed when Scientology was attacked first, I noticed that they kind of pivoted into the Trump camp, right? Trump was kind of at odds with the establishment. And when they got attacked, they kind of pivoted into the Trump camp. And like Trump, Greta Van Susteren, who was like a Fox News host, who was a Scientologist. He gave her a show on Voice of America. She was kind of forced out of Fox News. And they made a film then, American Made, with Tom Cruise, that was about the CIA connection to the drug trade. It was actually quite a well-made film. And I said, oh, that's because they're being attacked. And I've noticed that about the Catholic Church, too. When the Catholic Church gets attacked, the establishment largely has gone against the Catholic Church. And I've noticed the Catholic Church then, you know, we have the Pope criticizing Trump's wars and stuff, and that the Catholic Church has largely faced attacks for, you know, having too much power, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And so the Catholic Church then has to get better. And that as these kind of illiberal institutions get attacked, they tend to, you know, be forced to kind of clash with the establishment. And that leads to them doing good things. You know, and that illiberalism, you know, to some degree or other always exists in the liberal Western society. You know, the idea of the open society is kind of like a liberal fantasy. It has never been such from the time of the founding fathers who had slavery, right up to today, right? You can't have a liberal society without authoritarianism and, you know, ideological control to some degree or other, but they pretend that they can. And kind of what is the problem on the one hand is all of that illiberalism that just naturally exists in the liberal society is a threat to some within the power structure, no matter what. So they kind of don't want it to be there, even though they kind of need it for their systems. They have this love-hate relationship with all the illiberalism. But then on the other hand, at the end of the day, the liberal society, that human beings are just illiberal in their nature, and that the lie, the illiberalism of our society is almost worse because of the fact that we have the lie of liberalism. And, you know, if you go to, you know, you go to Iran, they'll tell you, we're not a real democracy. We're a guided democracy, right? Our democracy is guided by the people who led our revolution. We don't have total free speech. We don't have, you know, just pure democracy, whoever wins the elections. We're guided by our principles. And no, everybody knows that. The West, we pretend, oh no, it's just pure democracy. It's just whatever, but it's not, right? And it's we claim to be these purely open societies when we are clearly guided by those who have the most money and their beliefs and their agendas. There are things you're not allowed to say. We do suppress freedom of speech, and it makes it worse. Whereas in countries around the world that are openly illiberal, they say, look, our government has this ideology and this view. We do allow free speech within certain restrictions, but there are certain things you can't do. And they're honest about it. And that's kind of the weakness of the West, is that we claim to be completely open when we never have been, and we just cannot be, because that's not how human societies work. I believe the level of freedom in society expands as the level of wealth in society, the level of abundance and stability expands. You get more and more freedom. Obviously, nobody was talking about rights and freedoms anywhere in the world until like the 1400s in Europe. And that was because we'd never reached that level of development yet. So as society becomes more prosperous, we get more freedom. But at the same time, the West kind of claiming it has total freedom when it just can't do that is going to be, it's going to be its Achilles heel. I mean, that's going to be the weakness of the West.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation as ever. Caleb, where can people find you?
Center for Political Innovation, cpiusa.org. And I hope people will join our Kim Il-sung reading group. That's going to be exciting. We're kicking that off. We're going to see how that goes. But we've got a lot of exciting stuff in the works. We're organizing. We're having our 7-day summer training program coming up in August. That's going to be pretty great. You know, I'm going to be heading around the country in July, going to different cities, giving a talk about finish the American Revolution, defeat the British Empire system. So we have some pretty exciting stuff in the works. So Center for Political Innovation, cpiusa.org.
Fantastic. And you may be surprised. There might be a few right-wingers who are interested in North Korea as well. Probably for different reasons than the left-wingers are. But, you know, it's the closest thing to like an absolute monarchy that exists. And that's, you know, in the world at the moment. All right, Caleb, see you again soon.
Sure thing.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.